Hello, I'm Lina Ormudu. Welcome to Health Chat. On the program today, we look at how African scientists are leading the next wave of innovation and research on black skin and hair. I spoke with Damilola Faju-Yigbe, scientific and medical strategy manager for L'Oréal Research and Innovation. L'Oréal recently announced the recipient of its fourth Hair and Skin Research Grant. Damilola is leading the Africa Hair and Skin Research Grant by L'Oréal. Take a listen to our discussion. Damilola Faju-Yigbe, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
First of all, let's talk about your role and responsibilities as Medical Strategy Manager for L'Oréal Research and Innovation. What does your work consist of?
So as the medical strategy manager, I basically sit between L'Oréal and the hair and skin experts across Africa. What this means is that, and namely dermatologists actually, and what this means is that I talk to them a lot about what research needs to be done, how it needs to be done, identifying the priorities in the different countries about how we can support them. And then I come into L'Oréal to discuss, okay, how can we make things happen? How can we support the research in the different countries? This is the general gist of my role. And then from the L'Oréal side, you know, L'Oréal, we've been working on African hair and skin physiology for many, many years, for 15, 20 years now. And my job is to almost take the research that we're working on and make it more visible to the experts across Africa.
So what would you say are some priorities with the company on the African continent?
I can divide it into two things. When it comes to skin, discoloration of the skin is a big issue for all dark-skinned men and women, you know, and it presents itself in many different ways, this hyperpigmentation. It can be a melasma, which is age-related. It can be just the hyperpigmentation that you get after acne. So one of the key priorities for us in Africa, at L'Oréal Africa, is how do we provide a solution to hyperpigmentation on the continent. And then for hair, it's really about one of the big complaints about hair is hair length retention, you know, hair loss basically. So it's about providing solutions through some of our brands like Mizani and Dark and Lovely to help in the strengthening of the hair so it can be better retained. It's also about understanding the physiology of African hair. Because for many years, when we've spoken about African hair, we've really spoken about it from like, how do we define it? What are the structural elements of African hair? But now we are in the zone of understanding what is the impact of the grooming habits on Afro hair. And this is very interesting research because what we found, and this will be published hopefully next month, is, for example, the simple combing of your hair, did you know, can induce damage to your hair, which can lead to hair loss. And by empowering the continent with this information, you can adapt better solutions for your hair care. So these are the two fields that are very key.
Some observers say that the field of African skin and hair remains largely unexplored. What are your thoughts on that?
Absolutely. Even when you look at the number of dermatologists in Africa, they are significantly lower compared to any other continent. You know, in some countries in Africa, did you know you have as little as 10 dermatologists for the entire country? In South Africa has the highest number, I think at 190, then Nigeria has maybe 170, and every other country after that, like Ghana has 40 or 25 to 40, you know. So for me, the fact that we have a lot of questions yet to be answered because primarily we just don't have enough people asking the questions and doing the research. So definitely I agree there is so much more to be done. In fact, there is so much more to be done, not just in understanding African hair and skin physiology, which is where I'm currently working on with the grant, but also in the provision of scientifically backed products. So we identify this is the physiology of the African skin and hair. Then we go to the products that we offer. How can we ensure that it is effective on a scientific level? You know, so these are the two spaces that we need to work harder in.
Very interesting. Africaderm is a community established to promote exchange and knowledge sharing among dermatologists living in sub-Saharan Africa. How is this initiative transforming the work of dermatologists and their patients on the continent?
The aim of the community is for it to be fed by the hair and skin experts across Africa. You know, we have a blog section on the platform where the dermatologists can share with each other. And essentially, Africa Derm, the vision is for it to be a resource for all dermatologists that work across Africa, because you know that, oh, maybe you don't know, but a lot of dermatologists in Africa, they have a private practice. You know, and for us to be able to bring them together and allow them to share the information about what they are doing and what they wish to work on, this is, Africa Derm is the solution that we have provided for this. Also, you have some dermatologists working in remote areas around Africa. So having a platform like this, having a community like this, allows them to be able to share with each other. Also, another example I like to make is that when you think about dermatologists in Europe, right, they can fly to different congresses, they can fly to different countries. In Africa, this is not the case. We know this is not the case, because sometimes it is more expensive to fly from Ivory Coast to Senegal than it is to fly from Ivory Coast to France. So by having this platform where the dermatologists can feel it with the content that they want to see and the content that they're working on, we hope to build a community, a very strong community of hair and skin experts across Africa.
It is often said that when it comes to research in Africa, the lack of resources and recognition is more important, is more of an issue than the lack of expertise. So what can be done to ensure that African researchers get the support and recognition that they deserve?
I think there are more and more resources actually for African researchers. And I would like to believe that one of the solution is Africa Derm, to be able to bring more visibility to what people are doing. Because people are doing things. Researchers are doing things, but is it visible? So I would like to propose that Africa Derm is one of the solutions to increase the visibility of the dermatologists, to increase the visibility of the researchers, so that people know more about what they are doing or what they aim to do, and then it can fuel a bit of collaboration as well.
Let's talk about one of the company's initiative, which is the Africa Hair and Skin Research Grant that has been ongoing for the past few years. L'Oréal just announced the winners for this year's edition. Tell us more about the grant and what it consists of.
The grant is my baby. It's a fantastic program. Initially, in fact, the grant, the L'Oréal African Hair and Skin Research Grant, started in China, was successful in China, then it went to India, was successful in India, and then it came to Africa in 2013. And essentially, the propellant for the grant was when we had meetings, my manager, Dr. Vesho, had meetings and seminars and workshops across different countries in Africa, and she understood two things. One, there was a need of a society to bring together the African hair and skin experts, and two, there was a need of a structure to support the questions that the dermatologists wanted answers to. So the first question about the society led to the creation of the African Society of Dermatology and Venereology, which I recommend for anybody interested in African hair and skin to get into and to join the community. Because there you have, it's a Pan-African Society of Hair and Skin Experts. They meet every 2 years and they share the research and the insights that they're getting from the clinic and the research that they are doing scientifically. For the research grant is essentially, the aims of the research grant is fourfold. The first fold is to foster scientific research on African hair and skin. Number two is to finance a one-year study in Africa by African scientists and clinicians. Number three is to support the researchers by providing visibility and connections to experts in African hair and skin. And number four, which for me is very important, is to utilize the data generated by these scientists to build and to raise awareness for guidelines on hair and skin care.
So talk to us about this year's winners and what made their field of research unique compared to all the applicants.
So this year's winners, we have three winners this year. They were chosen by a panel of seven jurors, led by Professor Anissa Mossam of the University of KwaZulu-Natal in Durban. Professor Mossam is the acting head of the School of Medicine, and also she has written many scientific articles. She has even written a book recently on HIV in Africa. So the three winners were chosen by the panel of jurors who have expertise in different fields, in fact. We have three winners. The first winner is Professor Niamba from Burkina Faso. The second winner is Professor Rapela Noro from Madagascar. And the third winner is Dr. Kouassi from Ivory Coast. The topic of the first winner, what really made them sort of stand out was the quality of the proposal that is submitted, because the all of the submitted work is judged by a certain, we have an evaluation criteria that we judge the applications on originality, on feasibility, on how interesting it is for the African continent as a whole. So the first winner is looking at keloids, and he is looking at the factors that increases the risk of keloids. Why is this important? Because keloid is very hard to treat. If you're familiar, keloid is a hypertrophic scar. It's very unsightly. It's very hard to treat. So even in Europe, when I was doing my PhD, one of the things that you have to look out for, that you have to answer to, is does your research make a black person, make an African person at a higher risk of keloids, right? And you want to reduce the risk as much as possible. So even when I was young and I was doing my PhD, I had to work with dermatologists to understand how can I reduce the risk of somebody getting a keloid when I take a biopsy from them for my research. So his work, Professor Niamba's work, will be very interesting for us going forward to be able to do more research, but also to be able to work with the patients to make sure that whatever treatment regimen they are under does not induce a higher risk of keloids, number one. Professor Rapela Noro's work in Madagascar is looking at atopic dermatitis, and the prevalence of atopic dermatitis is crazy. It's so huge with children, with adults. So he is looking at trying to understand the relationship, the correlation between genotype, phenotype, environmental, and the treatment responses for atopic dermatitis. So trying to create a good picture to say, if this person presents this way with the atopic dermatitis, this will be their response if you give them this certain treatment regimen versus this treatment regimen. And then thirdly, we have Dr. Kouassi in Ivory Coast. Kouassi is doing a questionnaire study, and the questionnaire study addresses what are the risk factors that makes people more susceptible, that can make somebody more susceptible to acne. And you know, acne is very rampant across many different continents. So he's doing a very detailed questionnaire to map out to us, okay, when somebody has these dietary concerns or genetic factors, not genetic factors, it's a questionnaire study, at the end of the study, you will be able to explain to us a little bit more what makes somebody at a higher risk of having acne compared to another person.
So in a nutshell, what is expected of the recipients at the end of their research?
Published scientific article is all I require, because I believe in the documentation of what we see. So they do all the work and they are required to publish a scientific article at the end of the 1 year. And we are very serious about this. We even allocate a budget for it beforehand to make sure that they feel very supported, that when they do all this work, it will be what? It will be visible.
Again, any final words before we wrap?
It is really to encourage that anybody, any dermatologist or any expert working on African hair and skin, to continuously document what they see in the clinic, in the research world, so that we can learn more about our skin, so we can learn more about our hair. Because I do believe that it is with this documentation of the science, of the physiology of African hair and skin, that we will be able to provide and produce more targeted and effective solutions for the issues concerning our population.
Damilola Fajuyigbe, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Damilola Fajuyigbe, Scientific and Medical Strategy Manager for L'Oreal Research and Innovation. It is time for a short break. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Hello, I'm Peter Klose, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's weekend Africa show that provides news, features, and entertainment news, as well as sports about Africa and the world. Tune in, and you will be glad you did. I guarantee it.
Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Fali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America. Straight Talk Africa puts you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they talk about the most important social and political issues that affect you. Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Welcome back to Health Chat. Turning now to COVID-19, as COVID-19 infections soar in the United States, the African continent is bracing for a smaller surge after spending the year defying prediction that it would be hardest hit. Medical experts, including White House Coronavirus Task Force member Dr. Anthony Fauci and Dr. John Nkengasong, director of the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, are meeting virtually this week to discuss what the very different areas have learned from the pandemic. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
When Egypt discovered its first coronavirus case in February, African public health officials sprang into action. A week later, experts from the African Union's 55 member states convened at AU headquarters in Addis Ababa to come up with a plan. 9 months later, Africa's top health leader says that coordinated response spared the continent the worst of the pandemic, with 1.9 million recorded cases, fewer than expected for a continent with such low levels of infrastructure and social safety nets. And, says Dr. John Nkengasong, director of the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, it is proof that this continent is more than capable of battling a pandemic that has overwhelmed other societies.
The key unifying leadership of the continent very early on in February has been a very critical factor in moderating the spread of the virus on the continent. As a matter of fact, if the continent didn't go into a massive shutdown early on in March, with the rates in South Africa, for example, were doubling every 2 days. So I think that would have been a severe pandemic in South Africa.
Nkengasong says the pandemic proves that partnerships matter, and that a cooperative, coordinated approach is necessary to contain the spread of the virus. Dr. Anthony Fauci heads the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases in the country hit hardest by the pandemic, the United States. Fauci, speaking to medical experts by video conference late Monday, reiterated the five steps everyone must take to avoid the coronavirus. Wear a mask. Keep a 2-meter distance from others. Avoid crowds. Conduct any gatherings outdoors instead of indoors. And regularly wash hands.
If those five public health measures were adhered to universally and consistently over the country, it is clear from our previous experience with other nations and even regions in our own country, we would not be having the degree of surging of cases that we are currently seeing.
In some U.S. states, political leaders have embraced those measures. In others, governors have contested the importance of masks or declined to impose restrictions they say would hurt businesses. Fauci said the result is a surge in cases across the U.S.
Around June 19th, we had the beginning of a resurgence of cases due to the attempts to so-called reopen the economy or reopen the country, which was done variably with regard to adhering to the guidelines which came out. Different states did it differently. And we had a resurgence back up to close to 70,000, went back down, stayed around 40,000 for a while, and now is going up to 86,000 with a mean, I'd say an average of weekly, somewhere around 80,000. Unfortunately, on November the 4th, we hit 100,000 cases in a single day.
According to the Johns Hopkins University, the U.S. currently has more than 11 million confirmed cases and approaching 250,000 deaths. Meanwhile, Nkengasong notes that Africa's leaders are pushing the prevention measures anew as the continent braces for another coronavirus wave that seems to be emerging, concentrated in Algeria, Tunisia, Kenya, and South Africa.
There's a tale, a very worrying tale is beginning to emerge, and we are recording now about 10,000 cases per day. And very clearly showing that if not, something is not done, we will be getting a second peak sooner than later.
He said, if Africans stick together, in spirit, not physically, the continent will show the world it can beat the virus. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Organizers of next year's rescheduled Tokyo Olympics will have measures in place to limit the spread of the coronavirus. But little is known about how the virus affects the long-term health of those who were already infected, including athletes. South African researchers are leading an international effort to try to find answers. Details from Maurice de Klerk in Pretoria.
South African Olympic hurdler Venda Nel is grateful to be back on track for next year's rescheduled Tokyo Olympics after recovering from COVID-19, the disease caused by the coronavirus.
It was about 2 to 4 weeks that I've took it very slowly with the training, checked my heart rate every training session, just monitor that. And from there, I actually went into full program and I feel stronger, fit, and actually fully recovered right now.
The International Olympic Committee tasked a prominent South African sports physician, Martin Schwellness, to lead international scientists in compiling guidelines for doctors treating athletes recovering from acute respiratory infections, including the coronavirus. The University of Pretoria's Sport, Exercise Medicine and Lifestyle Institute, SEMLI, through the IOC Research Centre in South Africa, initiated the International AWARE Research Study as part of this work. The project includes data from the COVID-19 Recovery Clinic for athletes. Dr. Schwellness, who is a professor at the University of Pretoria and the director of SEMLI, says COVID-19 seems to affect various organ systems.
In the returning to sport, it could result in medical complications. And to date, we don't really know what these are for COVID. And so the focus of the project is to investigate what happens in the athlete when they've had COVID and how does the body heal and respond.
The project uses an online survey to gather data from any person training regularly for 3 hours a week who had acute respiratory infections, including COVID-19. Those recovering from the ailment can join the COVID-19 recovery clinic for help returning to sports. Medical doctor and amateur triathlete Marcel Juister joined the clinic after he recovered from COVID-19, which he caught from a patient.
I'm expected to follow a specific return to play protocol in terms of what I'm allowed to do in terms of exercise. That is, if I have passed all the testing, and then I am required to give them feedback in terms of how I feel following training.
17, 18, 19, 20. The research examines COVID-19's impact on all organ systems. According to preliminary findings, athletes who've had COVID-19 find low-intensity exercise to be harder and recovery time much longer than from other respiratory infections. Evidence-based guidelines should help recovering athletes to better and more safely prepare for the Tokyo Olympics, says Kelly Miller, rehabilitation specialist at the University of Pretoria's SEMLI.
If an athlete does happen to contract COVID-19, it would be really important and really valuable for the coaches and medical professionals to have evidence-based advice to guide that athlete back to their performance in the shortest time possible.
For Venda Nel and other Olympic athletes recovering from the infection, the research could help them come home from Tokyo as champions. Marise de Klerk for VOA News, Pretoria, South Africa.
There was a reason for new hope in the world when the Pfizer biopharmaceutical firm announced promising results in very early trials for a coronavirus vaccine. And although it may be a half a year before any vaccine by Pfizer or an estimated 200 other companies is approved by regulators and made available, national health ministries are already planning ways to acquire, pay for, and distribute it. To find out more about the challenges, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Dr. Jesse Goodman, a professor of medicine and infectious diseases at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., and a former chief scientist at the U.S. Food and Drug Administration.
One particular issue is access and affordability. The good news on that is global organizations are getting together, including WHO, CEPI, which has funded some of the R&D, Gavi, which finances vaccines for lower-income nations, not having this be something accessible just to well-off or Western nations.
Tell us about the challenges that you contemplate for the West and Africa once a safe coronavirus vaccine is available.
Certainly, distribution of vaccines to large numbers of people, being sure that can be safely done, tracking the doses. In many cases, you may need to track for a second dose. Most of these early vaccines are two-dose vaccines. So there's a huge logistic challenge for any country, and then for countries without as much healthcare infrastructure or funding, it could be really significant.
Can you give me a specific problem that will have to be addressed when distributing this vaccine? I'm thinking especially of remote and rural places.
Sure. Most vaccines already need to be protected when they're stored and transported by being in the cold. That might be normal freezing or refrigeration. But, for example, the earliest vaccines out, or at least the current one that gotten all the attention in the last week of Pfizer's, have to be transported at what we call ultra-low temperatures. And that uses freezers that aren't generally accessible, even in the U.S.
What happens if those double-dose vaccines get too warm?
They can lose their potency and they won't be effective. But there are many other vaccines being studied, something like 200 candidates globally, and several of them will probably only require one dose. So those will be much easier vaccines to use logistically.
Of course, there's also psychology at play here. Some folks here in the U.S. and in Africa simply don't trust vaccines of any kind.
Yeah, and we've seen that generated or exploited politically in the past. And there's a lot of mistrust of the pharmaceutical industry. Added to that, there is the global perception that because these are new vaccines and have been sped up in their research and development process, that they might not be safe. And so I think the communication about what is known about these vaccines is going to be really important, because you could have the best vaccine in the world, but if people don't trust it and don't trust the person or system administrating it, we're not going to be able to use them to help end the pandemic. And I would say one other issue for countries that are challenged in terms of their resources is, how much of a problem do they see COVID, and how does it compare to some of their other challenges? We see COVID in the scientific community as a highly contagious disease that could be quite severe and fatal, particularly for individuals with underlying conditions or older individuals. But some countries may be comparing that to potential resource use, for example, to measles, where the world is falling behind because of this COVID outbreak. So it's also going to be that countries are going to have to make decisions about where this fits in their priorities.
How does the COVID pandemic and its challenges compare to the Ebola outbreak of several years ago?
Very different diseases. Ebola, you know, requiring very close contact generally, but relatively easy to control, although obviously it took Herculean efforts. But public health measures could be quite effective there, even though the disease is more severe and terrifying, which certainly motivated people living in those countries to be interested in the vaccine. But on the other hand, coronavirus, much more common, much more contagious. I think we're going to learn a lot from it. It's still not clear where the money comes from. People have to raise the money every time there's a crisis. You know, this is true of global health in general. There really should be some kind of global health budget that when there's an emergency can be drawn from. We need to be better prepared the next time, because this isn't going to be the last pandemic.
That's it for this edition of Health Chat. For the latest news and coverage on the coronavirus pandemic, visit voanews.com. Check us out at facebook.com/VOA Health Chat, and let's keep the conversation going. Thank you all for joining us, and special thanks to all our affiliate stations throughout Africa for carrying Health Chat. I'm your host, Lina Romudu in Washington, with producer Dan Brown. Until next time, take care, stay safe, and wash your hands more frequently. Strive to make every day a healthy day.